no tax increases. Can I get an amen to that?
Anyone who tuned into Mitch Daniels' annual State of the State address to get a read on his presidential aspirations almost certainly came away disappointed. The only aspirations the Republican governor shared during Tuesday night's speech dealt with the General Assembly's 2011 session. Hi, I'm John Schwanis, and this is Indiana Lawmakers. In a moment, we'll dig into the governor's legislative agenda with someone who should have a pretty good handle on it. That is, the governor himself. Where does he think the budget act should and will fall? Does he expect to make significant headway with his push to reform education, local government, and the state's criminal code? And will he stick with his call for a truce on non-budgetary social issues? Oh, and yes, I'll ask him about the White House. All that and more on this edition of Indiana Lawmakers, from the State House to your house.
Purdue Research Park, 4 locations, 200 companies, 4,000 jobs. Purdue Research Park, the idea economy is here.
It took Mitch Daniels 32 minutes to deliver his 7th State of the State address. We, on the other hand, only have about 20 minutes to analyze it, so let's get right to it. Joining me is Indiana's second-term governor, Mitch Daniels, and I thank you for being here.
The speech was only 25 minutes, but...
It's all the applause. No applause. Nobody in the studio here to applaud, so we can get through a lot of territory.
We can make it.
I'm guessing right here. Let me ask you, you know where I have to start. It's obligatory, I think. Every journalist has to ask the question. In fact, every news organization, I think, except maybe ESPN, has asked you in the past year...
Why the Colts called timeout?
That's one of them. The other question is, will you run for president in 2012? I'm not necessarily asking you that, but I know PBS, CBS, NPR, NBC, ABC, Fox, they've all done it. I'm going to ask you, what question about your political future has not been asked yet that should be asked? They're not asking it the right way. Feel free to make news if you'd like. What's the question that they should be asking?
I won't say nobody's asked, but it seems to me anyone who is being thought of in that way should be asked, not will you, but why would you? I've said to all the people who brought this idea to me, let's not talk about the who, let's talk about the what. What is wrong in the country and what needs to be done about it? In other words, why would a person do what's otherwise not a very sane thing to do and put herself or himself through the meat grinder we call presidential politics. And so I wish more of the questions, I won't say it's never approached in that way, but I think that's the question we all ought to be asking ourselves as citizens, and certainly anybody who's thinking of something like running for president.
So not a yes or no, but at least... I'll ask you again later in the show. We'll see if we can get you.
Well, you still got 18 minutes.
18, yeah. We only took up two. Let me ask you another political question. Political discourse in our country has been under a microscope this week after the tragic shooting in Tucson, Arizona. You've been known to engage in some rhetorical sparring in the past. Most famously, you referred to former House Speaker Pat Bauer once as a car bomber. Not interested in recounting that, but political discourse these days in Indiana and elsewhere, is it a problem?
Yeah, sometimes. And may I point out that was 6 years ago, and you probably can't think of an item in between. Never called him anything, by the way. I said the act of suddenly walking off the floor and trying to kill our whole agenda was... I likened it to the ambush of a car bombing.
All right.
But anyway, I took a lesson from that, which is... That if you're interested in effectiveness, getting things done, trying to bite your tongue, turn the other cheek, and if others want to use that kind of language, just let them. But in the interest of getting things done, you got a better chance if you just roll with that and avoid it yourself. Now, this last week was interesting. What it said about our discourse was about the people who brought that up, I thought. It turns out this guy had absolutely no connection with politics of the right or the left. Now, he was, as we might have expected, a severely demented, deranged person suffering from, now it's clear, schizophrenia. And yet people pounced right away and tried to use it for political advantage. And that in itself is a misuse of political discourse. And I think those, now that they've been shown to be completely wrong, the people who started talking that way ought to say, oops, sorry, I was wrong, take it back.
Now, in terms of discourse, heading into this session, do you have to change your approach at all? Because even though this is your seventh State of the State address, it's the first one where you can look out and see two houses controlled by members of your party. Does that change the style of your approach or the rhetoric? Or you don't even have to be nice, frankly, to a lot of the Senate Democratic Caucus can't even walk out. There's a supermajority for Republicans. Does that change your approach?
Well, you heard the speech. It was full of bipartisanship, as they really all have been. They're all still on tape. You can go look at them again. But no, it doesn't change it. I've said 1,000 times that if you're trying to make big change, and every year we seek to make some big positive change for Indiana, the best way to do it is on an inclusive basis. That way you have a better chance of succeeding, and the changes, the reforms have staying power because more people feel bought in. And so we're approaching it that way. You know, think about the three things categories of change that I proposed: criminal justice reform, local government reform, and education improvement. All of them definitively bipartisan. President Obama and his administration agree with the things we want to do in education. The other two came from bipartisan commissions.
Well, I want to dig into those. Let me start first where you did with your speech, though, and that is the budget.
Yeah.
You've said, of course, no tax increases. You even called for an amen from the assembled lawmakers. You said no gimmicks. You're going to end up with a surplus, keep the state in the black. How do you do this? As we tape this, we're awaiting, of course, the release of your budget proposal. Even if you flatline spending, of course, the budget projections and the revenue projections are such that you'd have to fill or cut about $1 billion somewhere to get to where you need to be. Who's left on the proverbial editing room floor when the budget's done?
Reporters who haven't looked at the numbers.
You didn't bring them with me to look at them, so.
Here's what a lot of people have overlooked. We have already done the cutting. We took hundreds of millions of dollars out. People who are looking at what the last budget appropriated and comparing that to the revenue coming in would see a gap like you're talking about. What they haven't noticed is that we didn't spend that much money. Using the authority the legislature gave us, we took hundreds of millions of dollars out. We lowered the level of actual spending, and all we have to do is hold the line at that lowered level. It leaves some gap, but not nearly the one you're talking about, a very manageable one. So we're submitting a budget that, with really fairly minor changes from today's spending levels, will meet the four tests that I applied, and it will be in structural balance, no later than the second year, meaning money in exceeds money out. You don't need any of the savings account.
Now, the no new tax pledge or no tax hike pledge really stands out this week because of what our neighboring state to the west, Illinois, where lawmakers have approved an income tax hike of, I think, about 66%, if you calculate it. Right. The personal rate goes from 3 to 5, and I think business from 4-something up to the corporate rate up to 7. Does that help Indiana? I mean, can you make hay out of that?
Sure. And we'll try to do it. You know, as we've said repeatedly, our job strategy, and it's all we really concentrate on in the end, everything else points at that. It starts with lower taxes. We want to make it less expensive to hire people here. They're already two-thirds more expensive, John, over there. When you put it all together, all their different taxes, their workers' comp is 3 times ours, their property taxes are 5 times ours now, plus these others you mentioned. It was already two-thirds more expensive to hire somebody in Illinois, and now it's going to be more than that. And two very, very different approaches to how you try to create opportunity in a state. But their business community is testifying to the answer to your question. Mayor Daley said it yesterday, look out, and here goes more of our jobs. And we think we've built a very receptive environment for job creators over here, and if the gap just got wider, probably going to help.
Sounds like that line from last year's State of the State, as you put it, that German word that you can't pronounce,
Schadenfreude. Oh, I forgot that.
Well, you enjoy the woes of others? I don't say you're enjoying it, but
I've even teased our neighbors a little bit, but I always do say, and I mean it, we don't wish them ill. We are in one region in the end. It's not good long term for America. If states as important as California, which has historically been a driver of the American economy, and Illinois, if they continue down a path that drives jobs and investment out, it's not something really to celebrate.
Of course, this week you compared Illinois to the Simpsons, the Fox show, the Simpsons, saying it's the dysfunctional family up the street. So you can't be running for president. Think of all the electoral votes that would be in Illinois. See, I told you I'd get it back to that question. Let me ask you about school reform, because you started with the budget, but you spent basically half of your speech or more talking about education reform. And you said, the devil is not in the details. The devil, he's in the delay. Explain what you mean by that.
I just mean that it's past time. We've been talking about this a long, long time. It's now 27 years since a presidential commission got the nation's attention and said if a foreign enemy wanted to undermine the United States, they'd start by giving us the education system we have. 27 years later, it doesn't look much different here or in much of America, but that's changing fast. President Obama, I'm going to give credit again, is helping lead this nationally. Credit to him. And so the theme of the speech was that we've looked, we've analyzed, we've walked around, we've studied what works elsewhere. We know what to do, or at least some of the things. Of course, they won't be perfect, but they will be improvements, and others will come later and improve further. So that was the point I wanted to make. And, it struck me, and I included in the speech, it's now 12 years, 1999, Indiana passed the law, says this can't continue. These districts where kids are literally being lost for life. If they don't get better over the next several years, the state should take them over. The little children who entered first grade in that year are 18 now, and half of them in many of these districts will not be graduating from high school. And we cannot let another generation like that happen.
You know, we could spend the whole segment talking about education reform and your proposals. Let's touch on just a few of the biggies. Of course, merit pay for teachers, perhaps scaling back some of the collective bargaining agreements so it focuses just on salary and benefits, greater choice for parents, choice that would include not only other public schools and other districts, but non-governmental schools, the notion of kids getting out, who can get out of high school in 3 years, getting some of the money to... See, I have read that.
Yeah.
You
get past the jokes.
I get past that. We get to the substance. Of those... I know you'd like to see it all enacted, but in terms of the pecking order, are there certain things that you'd go to the mat for and other things that you're willing to see?
It's like asking me to choose between my children, These things are all important. They're not the only suggestions, the only things I'd like to see happen, and I think maybe the General Assembly may add some touches. These, I believe, are all very important. I think they fit together. Tony Bennett, our superintendent, makes this point all the time that all these things need to come together. You need excellent teachers, you need empowered local principals and superintendents who can really make decisions to be accountable, and you need both the civil justice of parents having choice, whether they're rich or not, wealthy or not, but also the competition that comes from schools knowing that they do a better job, they'll attract more students, and vice versa.
You met with Nate Schnellenberger, the head of the State Teachers Association, the morning after your State of the State address. How productive was that, briefly? And do you see that there is going to be some collaboration or partnership working on reform in that regard?
Well, that was a great conversation, hardly our first. We've had several. He's a fine gentleman. He really is. And I think that his union couldn't put a better person forward. It'll ultimately be for the union to decide if they want to come off their historic position, which is frankly, hell no to everything. I notice it happening elsewhere. There are other places in America where unions, not always that one, but some of their counterpart teacher unions are saying, well, maybe we ought to agree that it isn't right that the poorest teacher gets treated just as well as the very best teacher. Maybe we ought to agree that 99%+ of our teachers are not effective. That defies logic. and the facts. So I hope so, but I like him, and I think he's a person of real goodwill, and I know he's got to represent his members as they would want to be represented. But I hope they can find some parts of this to be for, and maybe they'll see that.
During the speech, you talked about some of the Asian countries and how they have been very successful in their education programs and preparing students for the workforce. You said in some of the countries you visited, they have school calendars that are 210, 220, 230 days a year versus 180 here. I bring that up because a member of your caucus, Mike Delf, Senator, is suggesting again that there may be a push for a ban on starting school until after Labor Day. This, of course, was an issue that created some buzz last year. I know that's not part of your reform proposal, but does that run counter to what you're talking about, which is extending the school year versus shrinking it?
No, not necessarily, and I don't think he means it that way. It would certainly run counter if it meant fewer school days. Honestly, we need more. We really do. It bugs the students when I tell them that, as I often do, but that ought to somewhere come into the picture. But it doesn't have to mean that. There's all kinds these days of these vacations and off days and so forth stuck into the school calendar. So, you know, it's not one of my proposals. It would run counter a little bit to my view that we ought to have more local control and more local flexibility. I personally, if I were a school board member, I might vote for a later start and a later end, but it probably ought to be left locally. But if the legislature wants to do it, that's okay with me.
The other reform proposals, you mentioned the three earlier we've talked about, education, local government reform, which we could describe basically as doing away largely with township government, or at least that's one element of it. I know there are other components of your plan. And then, of course, the criminal code reform. It would be the first rewriting of the code since, what, 1976?
Something like that.
Why are those two things on your front burner?
Well, criminal justice, first of all, it will give us, I think, a better correction system, and it'll save $1 billion over time. We concentrate our most expensive facilities on the worst offenders, and those that pose little or no danger to anybody can be supervised in other places in other ways. As for local government reform, ever since the Kern and Shepard report did their excellent, the commission did their excellent job, the facts have been there for all to see. We'd have a less expensive government for taxpayers, much more accountable government, much less of the, you know, this that you get when you have all these overlapping layers and multiple offices.
You'd basically do away with all, what is it, 1,008 township governments plus 4,000 plus officials, change the three commissioners to one local county executive. Yeah. Those are the...
Yeah, I mean, that's the system that exists in most states, and I think that it would fit us. I thought the commission did a really good job of presenting the case. But, you know, we've done 7 of the 27 recommendations, and most of those were amended or compromised in some way. And that may well be the case here, too. I've simply said, as I think it's my job to do, here's what I think the best idea is. Here's the way I do it. But let's see how much progress we can make. Maybe there's another way to get at the same goal.
Now, a lot of issues, of course, do break down along party lines. These two things are kind of the odd ducks. They don't. When you look at local government reform and the elimination of township government, and when you look at, changing the criminal code, it doesn't necessarily. It's not a Republican-Democratic issue.
Right.
But you do, of course, again, getting back to the point I made earlier, control your party controls both chambers. How much arm twisting is it going to take to assemble a coalition? Because you can't just rely necessarily on a Republican majority.
Well, it takes us back to your first question. Yes, our team had a very successful election. That's very important because many of these reforms simply weren't going anywhere when Speaker Bauer was in charge. The House passed 4 local government reform bills, Senate did, I'm sorry, 2 years in a row, and they just were DOA in the House. For instance, education reform, no changes were going to be considered. So the door is open. But it's what I find very encouraging is as you just said, actually all three of these major categories are very bipartisan. 2 of them came up from bipartisan commissions. That's where the ideas were fleshed out. Education, as we discussed, has all sorts. It's being led by Democrats in many, many states of the country. So to me, that's the best of all worlds. We're going to get a fair hearing for all these ideas, but there's a good chance that they can be passed with active participation by both sides. And that means that we'll make more progress, and that the progress will have endurance, because everybody had a hand in making it happen.
Of course, now those are your priorities. There are plenty of other mm-hmm. issues that aren't on the agenda, and that takes me back to a comment that got a lot of attention that you made last year about a truce on non-budgetary social issues. Now, I know since then you've said that you were referring in that now well-documented and much-talked-about interview to Congress as opposed to mm-hmm. the legislature. But how wary do you have to be of some of these issues, such as a proposed constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage or some additional restrictions on abortion? How wary are you that these could get in the way of some of these largely fiscal mm-hmm. reforms you're talking about?
I don't think they will. I don't think they need to. The legislature's got plenty of time and plenty of capacity. Clearly, they'll do a lot of things beyond the suggestions I made. I try to confine myself to the suggestions that I think will make the most difference for Indiana's future. That leaves lots of room and lots of time, and there'll be plenty of other bills. I don't know which ones. So as long as it doesn't, there's nothing that threatens to derail some of the progress that's so essential for us all. And I can't imagine that.
If additional abortion restrictions and perhaps the same-sex marriage ban get to your desk, what happens? Does it get your signature?
Well, of course, the same-sex thing would never get to my desk. It's a resolution that the legislature either does or doesn't do it. I've signed several bills to extend and protect the right to life. This is, by all definitions, the most pro-life administration in the history of the state of Indiana. And so that's completely consistent with our views and our record. But, whether this will be a factor this time, we'll all find out together.
All right, last question. If your agenda is enacted and you sign it all, wouldn't that be a good, hypothetically speaking, a good launch pad for, say, a presidential campaign? Again, feel free to make news.
That'd be in the eye of the beholder. I don't know. I don't know another thing to do, John, except all these ideas have been in our thinking for a long, long time. We've been trying to move them ahead. We launched the Kern and Shepherd Commission. We launched the Criminal Justice Commission, and I've been working to try to get us to a point where we could really step forward in education. And I promise you, I'm not thinking about anything else but doing as well as we can by Indiana in our 8 years. And I'm Presbyterian, and we're supposed to believe that what will be, and that's kind of my outlook.
We'll come knock on your door the morning after the 29th of April. Again, my guest has been Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels, a second-term Republican. I thank him for joining us.
Enjoyed it.
Thank you. On the next Indiana Lawmakers, we'll look at what promises to be one of the key issues this session, education reform. And time now for our weekly conversation with Ed Feigenbaum, publisher of the newsletter Indiana Legislative Insight. Well, Ed, our audience will be pleased to know I'm not going to ask you about Mitch Daniels' presidential aspirations. Let's stick to the State of the State address. Any surprises?
I think the surprise was that there wasn't much of a surprise. Usually a governor will throw something in that was kind of unexpected, but he's really outlined his entire legislative agenda through November and December, and so that didn't leave a whole lot of room. But what we really saw was kind of a repeat of what we saw 10 years ago and 20 years ago from Governor O'Bannon in 2001 and Governor Bayh in 1991. They referenced the national recession and the president and his administration kind of putting us into bad straits and Indiana having tough times because of the national problems and how we had to make some cuts. They were going to be tough cuts, but we were going to come through it and we were going to lead the nation.
You dug into your archives. We may have to get, we'll try to get a cutaway shot of those State of the State addresses from the past. We talked about what's in the speech, no surprises, but basic content that he's talked about in recent months. What wasn't in the speech that you thought might have been there?
I think that some people were hoping that there'd be, especially with the big emphasis on education and education reform, there would have been more talk about preschool initiatives and particularly paying for full-day kindergarten, something that this governor has really pushed for. And now that the onus is really on the state to pay for these things, then maybe the state could pick things up as the districts were experiencing even more financial problems. But alas, that was not in there. I also thought that there'd be more of an emphasis on the energy initiatives that he's pushed for the last couple of years, at least in terms of reinforcing how the state is trying to become a leader in the clean coal area, particularly. I thought that as he was reciting some of the things that were major accomplishments over the past few years, that that would have found its way in there.
And quickly, thumbs up or thumbs down in terms of what success you think he'll have on some of these reform measures this session?
I think he'll do real well on many of the education things. I think only achieving some successes at the margin on the local government reform.
Very good. Appreciate your being here, Ed. Thank you.
For more information about each week's show, additional content, and contact information, go to WFYI.org/lawmakers. We look forward to hearing from you. You can follow live streaming coverage of the General Assembly on the Internet at www.in.gov/legislative or check the digital broadcast channel of your local public television station. Remember, you can get our show on demand from Xfinity. Just go to Hoosier TV and look for Indiana Lawmakers. Well, that concludes another edition of Indiana Lawmakers. I'm John Schwantes. Take care.
The idea economy is here at the Purdue Research Park. A powerful economic engine creating a string of high-tech companies, dynamic ventures, jobs, opportunities, and a technology conduit from Chicago to Louisville. The innovation train we created with Purdue Research Park System puts Indiana at the forefront of a tech future that can transform lives. Purdue Research Park, the idea economy, is here.